Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, everyone, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and my co-host this evening, my PR manager, media maven, and stellar co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. So, good evening, Delilah. What's happening in your world tonight?
Well, I'm here with you. I'm in another show on a Saturday.
I'm so excited.
Well, I am, too. I'm very, very excited about our guest and StressResources.com and Pam Ressler. It's, you know, we often run at such a pace, and the way that life is these days, we're all running, and we've got to learn how stress is affecting us. And it's, you know, we're all stressed about something, and it's affecting us physically, it's affecting us mentally and spiritually as well. And I'm really, really excited for her to jump in and cure us.
Yeah, I think she has a lot to lend it. And can I just mention a couple things very briefly before we begin? This is a two-hour special, ladies and gentlemen, so don't shut off after the first hour, because we have two for the price of one. We have Dr. Delilah Corey pre-taped earlier, so we have two wonderful guests for you. And the other thing I just wanted to mention briefly is that, you know, it's, I always say, and I hope people don't get bored of me saying this, but I really am truly appreciative of having this radio show. And I think one of the prime benefits is that when I invite a guest on, we, you know, I may or may not know them. Many of the people that I've had on for over a year, I have some relationship, but many of them I have not. And it's not just a one-shot deal, Delilah. I feel as if it's my goal to build a continuing circle of friends and colleagues. And I think for the large part, we have done that. We have created a circle of friends. So I'm hoping that Pam Ressler will be among those people. It's just one of the things that make this show and this venture with your company so rich and rewarding. So, you know, I just wanted to say that up front, and I mean that sincerely, you know. So without further ado, let me give just a very short bio of our guest. Pam Katz Ressler is a nurse by training. She was an honors graduate at the University of Michigan School of Nursing and received advanced certification in holistic nursing. She is an adjunct faculty member at the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, lecturing on topics such as what we're going to get into in detail, stress resiliency. She also has additional training in mind-body medicine through Mind-Body Medical Institute affiliated with Harvard Medical School in Boston. She's on the board of directors of the Integrative Medicine Alliance and a co-coordinator of Healing Arts Team at Mass General Hospital for Children, as well as an adjunct faculty member at UMass Boston College of Nursing and Health Sciences, where she teaches stress management skills to undergraduate students. So that is, I think that is very important, you know, to get that kind of knowledge, you know, early on. So, Pam, welcome to Shattered Lives. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Donna. And hello, Delilah.
Hello.
And I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're here. I think this is such an important topic, and, you know, people just don't realize, and I know you're going to do a great job of filling us in on not only the causes of the stresses in our lives, what we can actually do about it and still function and function better.
Yeah, I think that as we think about stress, we need to think about it in through all domains in terms of psychological stressors, but just the speed up of our lives in general, certainly in this country, and how technology has played a role in our perception of leading more stressed lives.
Right.
I think that we often discount it as, if I could only get a few more things done, I would be less stressed. But actually, research shows the opposite, that mm-hmm. we are all trying to be great multitaskers all the time. And in effect, we actually can be more productive or efficient by consciously choosing to take a few pauses in between the crazy lifestyles that we do lead. And I'm somebody who loves technology, so I'm not talking about unplugging totally, but making some choices that way. And I work with a lot of folks, certainly caregivers, professional caregivers, who are in very high stress positions and professions. But I also work a lot with folks themselves living with life-limiting or life-altering illness, and their family caregivers. And so I see not just the crazy work-life balance that many of us struggle with, but layered on top of that, living with chronic disease, chronic illness, and how what things we can do to be a little more resilient, meaning not being able to bend with adversity and bouncing back from adversity.
Right. Well, that certainly sounds like, you know, a tall order, and it is so needed. You know, every single person on this planet could use the types of things that we'll be getting into. And would you be able to perhaps in the beginning here provide us with a bit of a framework about how you developed your passions and how Stress Resources LLC evolved?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'd actually been in the nursing profession for several decades before I formed my company back in 2001. And I had really used many of these tools of stress management that I now incorporate when I work with individuals and organizations that were really based on mind-body tools, relaxation techniques, meditation techniques, but I hadn't really seen them as essential as they certainly became in the late 1990s and 2000s. I think a lot of things happened in those years, certainly in our country and our shifting. You know, after 9/11, my business got quite active with folks really seeking some of these tools. I come from the healthcare background into this work, but also from a personal background of surviving losses and knowing that it is challenging when you feel your control has been taken away. And so I wanted to really form a company that certainly would allow people in whatever challenges with transitions and resiliency issues they may have to kind of find a common ground in using some of these tools to actually live more meaningful, productive, and effective lives.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that sounds like, you know, when we have a career that spans X number of years, like I was a medical speech pathologist for nearly 25 years, and then you see another need and it tends to evolve, and this seems kind of a natural evolution from what you describe. Is there a greatest need that you feel, I know maybe this is a hard or too general of a question, in terms of what needs to be addressed concerning the demands that people have that are placed on them so that we can try to maintain a better balance and, you know, a better quality of life? Is there something that perpetually keeps popping up, that there's always that need there to be addressed?
I think I keep circling back to this idea of mindfulness, and it's gotten a lot of interesting press, this concept of what we talk about with building mindfulness or awareness. But that's actually what we now know through neuro research, through functional MRIs, et cetera, that this idea of cultivating and teaching mindfulness to people is a commonality that across the board for workplace situations, for health situations, for caregiving situations, for grief situations, this idea of being able to step away from the ruminating thoughts of what has happened and the fearful thoughts of what will happen, and just settle in, and giving people some skills to settle into the present moment, it seems to be a wonderful adjunct to whatever else they're doing. So I think if it all came down to one word, it probably would be mindfulness, and that can take many forms. But the ability to be present with how our lives are unfolding, whether we like it or not, is kind of the first step, and also the step that we can work with.
Is that a hard thing to teach?
Yes, it is. it's challenging, and what I'm really thrilled with is that there is a lot of research going on around this concept of mindfulness, that those of us who have been teaching these skills for a number of years are now finding validated in scientific research. But it is challenging because we have stepped away from being in the present moment a lot. And it's hard and it's challenging when people are going through very stressful situations, because our bodies are in that, and minds are in that fight or flight response. And with that, our decision-making is impaired. Our ability to heal is impaired. And so dropping into mindfulness, what we found is skills of teaching some of these tools, we can have a direct effect on the immune system, levels of cortisol. And I know your previous guests have spoken about some of this. It also helps us see the forest through the trees a bit. So I think it is some hard training, but from my experience, it makes a world of difference for folks. Mm-hmm. And so there is a framework that has been studied a great deal. Actually, it's out of the University of Massachusetts in Worcester, the medical school, and it was formulated back in 1979 by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who you may have heard of, who really started this idea of bringing these tools of mindfulness, of resiliency, of using some tools of meditation into medical situations. And he started with chronic pain patients, and they found quite remarkable results in terms of their level of pain perception after about 8 weeks. This program has been going on for well over 30 years, so we've had a long time to look at results and other types of illnesses and reasons to use this, and they've all been equally as encouraging. So it is challenging to learn, but some of these tools you can learn very quickly.
Very quickly
of really just dropping into the moment for 5 minutes, which will seem like 5 hours to most people.
I'm sure for type A people like me, yes, I know. I'd be a challenge.
It's challenging, but it can be done. It can be done.
So hard with... to get her to learn how to use meditation. And Donna, just like Pam said, try for 5 minutes. You don't have to do like a whole hour or half an hour even, but just 5 minutes makes a world of difference.
Some of the really interesting research around this, and, you know, I circle back to really what my company does, and that's really building resiliency tools along, you know, stress is kind of what people think they're coming to me for, but it really is building kind of this overall part of resiliency. And some of the really interesting work has been done in the past couple of years in the neuroimaging labs, actually at Mass General Hospital in Boston. And what some of their very small early studies are showing is not only is there a change in activity that happens in the brain when people learn some of these skills based on mindfulness types of meditation? And those changes tend to replicate the types of changes that we see in brain activity with certain antidepressant medications. So there are certain ways that it looks very similar. But beyond that, what I find really fascinating is with some of these early studies, they're also finding that there may be structural changes that occur in the brain itself by learning some of these tools and utilizing them in as little as 8 weeks' time. And the two areas of the brain that, again, these are very small early studies, and I wouldn't want to suggest this is generalizable at this point. We need larger studies. But the two areas of the brain seem to be the amygdala, seems smaller. And the amygdala is the area of the brain that is our fear center and is the area that gets very stimulated when we are in stressful situations, when we have had trauma, when we are on guard, so to speak. And so that area seems to be reduced in size in folks who practice some of these tools or learn these tools of mindfulness, of resiliency skills. The area of the brain called the hippocampus seems to be larger. And so that's a really good combination because the hippocampus is the area of the brain that's associated with learning, memory, all of these great things that, you know, when you're under a lot of stress, you know, stress kind of makes you stupid sometimes, doesn't it? You know, you can't remember what you're doing.
We can't remember.
You know,
we were referring to that earlier today, weren't we, Delilah?
Now I know what it is.
So in certain ways, so these are some really cool, what I think are really cool, interesting findings that actually validate what we've known or suspected anecdotally for the time that we've been using many of these tools to teach folks. And the other really interesting thing is that these have a really positive effect, and these tools of building resiliency, on increasing high level of effectiveness and performance. And so it's not shirking away from the stress. It's actually shifting it from being distressed, like disease, to eustress, e-eustress, meaning good stress, actually an activation, but using it to your benefit and knowing how to manipulate it a bit.
That's what's going on in the brain once you do some of these techniques for over a period of time?
Yeah, because you're able to regulate much more responsively versus reactively. And not to say that you're not going to have these high levels of activation, but you have a little more distance and a little more ability to choose. So what we see is even with professional athletes, if they are trained using some of these tools, they're able to be in the zone, that kind of perfect cross-section or apex of their best performance and best efficiency, and they're able to hit that sweet spot much easier. Actually, the Olympic rowing team was trained in the U.S. Olympic rowing team in many of these tools. Professional basketball teams, as silly as that may sound, Phil Jackson, the great coach Phil Jackson, was a longtime meditator, actually, and brought some folks to teach these skills around stress management with a basis in meditation tools of mindfulness to both the Chicago Bulls and the L.A. Lakers quite a few years ago now. But it happens to be those were their winning years that they were trained in this. So it's an interesting thought to think that, you know, something that we can do with our mind has such a profound effect on how we really meet the world.
I think the study is just so fascinating about, you know, neuroscience and neurotransmitters and how the brain actually works, and yes, how we can manipulate it into from going from here to there just by using tools like yours and other things as well. And, you know, the study of neuroscience with the different personality disorders and how some are curable and some are not. So I think it's just a fascinating study in its own. And to bring it to the public, to bring it down to our levels, the average person in, out here, to be able to understand it and how learn how to use it, I think is really, really important, because you in the medical background, with your medical background, you know, understand these things. And our next Dr. Akori as well, she understands these things from medical terms. And in conversations that we've had, it's like, you know, you have to dummy it down a little bit for me here.
Well,
and I think your tools tend to do that very well.
And I think, you know, part of our job in the medical realm is to translate this work into accessible ways that this makes sense for everyone. And how can we how can we translate it better? So people don't need to go into the medical journals and read through the information to say, oh, I'd like to try this. And so actually that's kind of part of what I do also. As somebody who is so into stepping back into the moment, you might be kind of surprised to see how engaged I am in social media. And it seems a bit ironic.
But, yeah, it's a contrast, huh? Yeah, in terms
a bit ironic and a bit of a contrast. However, I feel that that's where the public is. And so this information and how I can engage in conversations around this in a platform and in a media that I have some trust because of my credentials, and I think because of the work I've done, and yet I can get the material out there. So that's one of the reasons I spend a lot of my professional life also studying how resiliency you know, can be talked about a little differently and more accessibly to folks.
Can you tell us whether now some of us, depending upon the life circumstance that we've had, I'm wondering if it genetically based. I mean, well, a person, I'll take me as an example because it's so easy. Someone else that might have gone through what I've gone through you know, cerebral palsy, having 55 surgeries for two different medical issues, and then a homicide of a parent. I survived through that. In fact, I'm thriving, I think, at this point in my life, because I've been able to take it and utilize it, you know, for the positive. Whereas, you know, somebody else, if you gave them that same set of circumstances, Pam, maybe they would be curled up in a ball. I mean, I don't know. So with respect to talking more in depth about resiliency, whether it's someone going through a violent crime or on the threshold of entering our very stressful healthcare system these days, or someone going through a terminal illness like our friend Susan Murphy Milano, how do we, you know, how do you determine if one person is going to make it through another person, or can these resiliency skills be learned?
That's a great question, and one that I'm asked a lot. And I think that they can be learned. I think it's easier for some people than others, but I believe that there are certain components that can be strengthened and actually taught to allow people to not only survive, but, as you say, also thrive. And some studies that have been done throughout the last decades really have looked at what are these commonalities. I mean, you know, somebody who's had a devastating event, whether a natural disaster, a personal disaster, whatever that may be, what are some of the commonalities about those people who seem to be able to ride the wave, so to speak, versus getting pulled under? And a researcher named Suzanne Cabasa studied this in workplace situations. And Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor, also studied this in concentration camp survivors. I mean, why did some people who did survive concentration camps seem to be able to survive and go on and make meaning out of their lives, and others who survived died very quickly after, or weren't able to make that transition back into the world? And so some of the, they're actually, I call them the three C's, and I'm going to add a fourth C on there. But Suzanne Cabasa highlighted them over 20 years ago. And the first one was control. And if you've had a violent crime, trauma, a chronic disease, or a terminal illness diagnosed, you've lost a lot of control, or at least that's what it sure feels like in the first go round of the initial shock. Mm-hmm. What we try to do is to look at that sense of control, and is there a way that we can shift the control internally versus externally? So control with a patient may mean being an informed, engaged patient. What are the tools that we can put into place? It might be something seemingly as simple as learning how to do some relaxation breathing when things become too difficult to deal with. That's a stepping into a sense of control. We can talk about other ways of control, but so that's the first C. The second C is feeling a sense of commitment that I can gather some forces around me. I can, I might have some choices. I feel a commitment to understanding the situation a little different, but that's kind of a looking outside of oneself, whereas the control is looking within. Seeing danger or crisis or disaster even as understanding the difficulty in it, but also seeing it as a challenge And that's not being Pollyanna about it, but encountering it as a significant challenge versus retreating totally. And my fourth C that I think is actually...
Oh, I missed the third one. What was that?
Control, commitment, challenge.
Oh, challenge is the third one. Okay.
Yep. So my fourth one that I'm going to add to that is connection. And I think that actually should be the first one if I were to write this again. The three C's were kind of delineated by Suzanne Cabasa, and the fourth C that I see as essential is a sense of connection. Because when we are traumatized, when we have a life-limiting illness, when we have an invisible illness, we isolate ourselves not necessarily because we want to, but that's how human beings often operate when they feel under unremitting stress. And mm-hmm. you can think of, animals, they retreat to their caves. We tend to isolate ourselves, and other people isolate us.
But do you think that that's necessarily always a bad thing?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know in my case, sometimes I just to be in solitude. I don't want to hear other voices. I don't want to hear the telephone. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to be responsible for saying thank you to everyone for everything that they've done. And people, I don't mean to sound like I'm not thankful, because that's not it at all. But it with something like this situation, there's so much that you're bombarded with all in a very short period of time. And sometimes, in my case anyway, I have to pull back. I have to isolate. I have to mm-hmm. just put my own ducks in a row before I can come back out and be halfway.
Face the world. It takes so much energy, too. Are you talking about that part of it, too, Delilah?
Well,
yeah,
I agree.
It does take a lot. It does. And it's, the situation I went through was really kind of an abnormal situation, in my opinion. And in the sense that this Susan, our friend, was a very well-known person, and there were thousands and thousands of people all over the country who knew her. So, it was kind of, it still is in some ways, being under the looking glass as to so much help was there. So much help that it was almost overwhelming in some way. And I want to really take this moment briefly to thank everyone who stepped forward, who called me, who texted, who, emailed, everybody who did everything and anything that they could to help me. It is so appreciated, and it goes on and on. But there was a time when I had to pull out. I had to, hide under the covers and not communicate.
Sounds normal to me.
It is normal. And I guess I don't mean connection in that very outward sort of way of connection. I mean connection in however makes you feel resilient. So for some people, the connection might be their spirituality. Feeling larger than oneself, I guess, is also a way to think about connection, making meaning, which I'm so sorry for your loss. It sounds like what an incredible story and journey.
It is.
So the control piece comes in to actually what you were just relating. That was a choice to pull back because it was overwhelming. You were putting control into a situation that because of all of the well-wishers and all of the people who were doing good, felt so overwhelming that your control was, I need to be with myself a little bit. And then you bring yourself back into the connection. So I'm seeing that as a very positive use of that control piece.
Well,
does that make sense?
Hear that.
Good for you, Delilah. We're proud of you.
One of the things that we haven't talked about that might be a little related to this also, and it's kind of allowing people to find whatever connection or reaching out or not that they want to do, is the use of things like patient blogs or caregiver blogs. I was on a research team that just published a paper on communicating the experience of chronic pain, chronic illness through blogging. And what that allows seems to be this ability to just listen, if you would like, to other people's thoughts about similar things, or to share your own experiences, or to just be helped for a while. One of the comments that we got when we surveyed people who have chosen kind of to find their resiliency through some of these tools of therapeutic writing and then putting it in a space such as an online blog has been, first, they were incredibly helped just by knowing that others were out there in a way. Then they did a lot of listening and a lot of healing themselves. And then they kind of transitioned into being the helper, and that was very empowering. And so, I mean, that's another way of kind of choosing how much connection you want and communication you want, and also being part of the world still.
And it's having that vehicle of communication when you don't feel like personally engaging. I mean, wasn't that one of the purposes of conqueringcancer.me, Delilah? That, you know, that was a way to connect, but yet you didn't have to personally connect all the time, but you kept people up to date, correct?
Yeah.
Is that part of it too, Pam?
Absolutely. And what we found was you're overwhelmed with when a tragedy of a diagnosis or a trauma happens, but you need to let people know what's happened. And so it's overwhelming to make all those phone calls or send all those emails or answer the phone.
There's no way.
You can't. And that's also not healthy for your resiliency because you will exhaust yourself before you're done answering the phone and the emails. So getting the information out and kind of information gathering at first, we found is one way that people feel the control back in that situation of being out of control. And if you kind of take it back to that 4C model, the commitment is when you do start something like writing in that sort of way, often there's an underlying current of commitment. You know, somebody might be out there who needs to hear this as it kind of transitions into a next stage. Certainly there's a challenge to do it, and then there is this connection. And what while therapeutic writing is very reflective, it's rather insular. And so by putting out, you know, in the new media form, it can be both reflective of what the experience, but it doesn't have to be. It can be more of a gathering spot for friends to send their well wishes without you having to reach out in that same way when you're exhausted to do that. It's wonderful for the caregivers as well as the person who may be facing
And there's a permanent record there, too. Mm-hmm. I found that, just as an example, a couple of days ago happened to be Susan's birthday or would-be birthday. Mm-hmm. And to have another entry on that blog that July was started was like, oh, my God, it felt like an old friend going back and reading what not only what she wrote, but to know that all the story was all there. And if you felt like you needed something from that, you could go back and see from the very beginning. And I felt in my heart that she was there. It's mm-hmm. there as a record.
I think that's really important, because one of the things for those who are the caregivers and those left behind is that that person not be forgotten. And that right. there continues to be that connection also. After the Newtown tragedy, mm-hmm. you know, we see faces of resiliency popping up, certainly in the direct aftermath. But this creates a whole nother kind of layer of these are parents who have lost children at a very young age, and what are their next steps in their healing process of building resiliency, but allowing that child's memory and their life have meaning at such a young age. And so I'm certainly in awe of those parents who have started to step out of their, you know, incredible grief.
There's just so many incredible things being started from many different types of organizations, mm-hmm. to people getting involved legislatively, you
Absolutely.
Know, as a state government employee. I'm seeing it. It's just so much a part of our fabric here. It's only a couple of months, but still, they have to make meaning in their life and find something to hold on to. And they are doing it every day. In our local papers, there's a new story about something
yes.
positive that has come out of this, Pam, and it's just very, you know, it's very heartwarming to see that you can take something so horrific and turn it around and use it for the good.
And without denying that something horribly horrific happened. And,
right.
And, you know, obviously, if we could turn back the clocks, as all of us could, we would go there in a heartbeat. But now that we can't, how can we move through this? And that's really the resiliency. And I blog quite a bit, and the Newtown tragedy had a special meaning for me, since I did lose a child through illness. And mm-hmm. I did write a blog post right after Newtown tragedy happened.
I read that the other day. It was wonderful.
Thank you. And just to kind of give those parents a sense that, you know, you can find hope and healing even with the darkest tragedy that you can ever imagine happening. And
Sam, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh,
but
no problem.
Have you ever had the experience of working with families that have missing loved ones? And because I know, you know, with being in contact and working with a lot of these families, their trauma isn't just a trauma that happens and then you work your way out of it. It's such an
ongoing.
Nightmarish over and over and over every single day for, you know, years and years of pieces.
Yes.
How do you speak to that? Is it a different situation? Do you deal with it differently? How would you
slightly differently, although there truly are the commonalities. And it's the grieving process is slightly different. However, it is a loss and a grieving process. And we work with that in a somewhat similar way. I have worked with mothers who their children have left from their lives, whether by choice or not. And it's an incredibly difficult process because there isn't that end set point that when there is an event, so to speak, and somebody dies or then there's a different trajectory. What it equates more towards is those living with a life limiting or an illness that is very unpredictable. And so I see similarities there because it's this watchfulness, this hypervigilance perhaps, but this mm-hmm. grief and this loss that continues and continues and continues. And the most important piece I see is really honing in on that family with building those tools of mindfulness, of finding how their life can go on with this unknowing also. And it's a hard journey. I wish
and
I could say there was...
And it's got to be so stressful on your body over a period of time because you never get a sense of, here's a wrestle. It's just continuous.
Well, I think, it kind of relates to also, how we're viewing our own level of ability to deal with adversity has a great effect with our body. And I think that when we are put into situations that have no set endpoint, it's a chronic stressful situation. But mm-hmm. if we feel that somehow we have the coping skills to deal with the what if and whatever, mm-hmm. we actually can do okay. And I'll go back to kind of an interesting study that was in a lot of the lay media a couple of years ago, and I find this another really interesting thing. It was a study of younger women who are moms. I think they were between the ages of mid-20s to mid-40s, which for women is kind of our healthiest age span because that's typically the childbearing years. And so with this study, what they looked at were moms with kids without any chronic illness or chronic disease, and then they matched them up to groups of moms who had chronically ill kids. But the illnesses ranged from kids with some mild ADHD who were in normal mainstream classrooms, ranging to kids who basically the moms were providing 24-hour physical care, kids with significant chronic life-limiting illness. And so what they were looking at were not how sick the kids were, but what they were looking at was the mom's perception of the amount of stress in her life, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then what they measured in the moms was something called their telomeres. And the telomeres are telomeres in the British pronunciation, telomeres in our pronunciation, are these little caps on the ends of our chromosomes. And as we age, they normally shrink. I mean, that's part of the aging process.
Mm-hmm.
So what they found were the moms with the healthy children without any chronic illness had a normal range of the size of these telomeres. The moms with chronically ill kids, depending on their level of stress that the moms perceived and not necessarily the diagnosis of the child that we in the medical profession would say, oh my gosh, they must be under tons of stress because mm-hmm. that child is very sick. And the mom's perception of the level of stress had an effect on how fast their telomeres were shrinking. And mm-hmm. the moms with the chronically ill kids who had the most perception of stress had about a 10 to 15 year more rapid degradation or shrinkage of that end, that telomere. Now, why is that important? Because we think that that has to do with how early you start to get diseases of aging. And if you've ever seen a caregiving mom who's under tons of stress, they seem to age before your eyes, don't they? Or
right.
Other people
yeah.
who are caregivers. And so actually one of the study authors was Elizabeth Blackburn, who won the Nobel Prize on some of this research with Alyssa Apple, one of her assistants. So I find this fascinating because it had nothing to do, actually, with the kids' stress or their level. But this was the first study that showed that the psychological stress of ourselves and somebody else, your perception
mm-hmm.
of it has a physical effect on your body. They were
yeah.
not measuring the kids. So when we look at caregivers, at families who have met with incredible challenges and adversity,
mm-hmm.
we actually need to be concerned with those folks as much as the victim or the child or the husband or wife who is the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important for these tools of resiliency to actually be built in there. So those moms who felt, I know this is a bad situation, but I can do this.
But I can do it, yeah.
But I can do this. Or I can find ways to do this. Or I don't feel totally
like it's taking over my life. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that I will be okay. Or maybe I don't know if I'll be okay, but at least I can try these few things. Actually do better. And we're not talking about outcomes. Most diseases are treatable but not curable, most chronic diseases. So we're talking about more and more people who are in this cohort of folks. If they can feel that they're more resilient,
mm-hmm.
we're actually probably not going to see those stress-related diseases of aging at earlier and earlier years.
Yeah. How do you get to that population so that, you know, these effects don't start to take hold and premature death and all of that?
Well, actually, the study was done with the intent that, okay, now what do we do with this information? And they're going to start doing a lot more things like yoga groups and support meditation groups at an earlier stage and really targeting some of these caregivers.
Caretakers, caregivers, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I think we're going to start to see that become more prevalent. Of course, it's a challenge, though. I mean, you know, if you're a caregiver, how do you sneak out to do a our support group or something? And so
know. Delilah, did you ever feel like you could sneak out to do whatever that at that point in time?
Well, in that case, I was very, very fortunate that Susan had Dr. Akori, here next hour, because she utilized, you know, everything that you're speaking about, and I was included in everything there. You know, that was one of the things I think that surprised me so much is I didn't expect it, but I was included in everything. So a lot of time, you know, she and Susan would work on meditation and calming and, you know, using those tools, and I was a part of it. So, and actually, Susan and I both had done a lot of meditation in the past, and we knew the benefits of it and utilized it as much as possible. So, you know, I had that little leg up, but it was, you know, had I been in another circumstance, had we been in another doctor's office, I don't think, you know, my outcome would have been as balanced as I now kind of feel it's getting
But it's one thing I did know is that there just isn't a lot out there as far as resources and information for caregivers.
That's right.
You know, it's something you're in my case anyway. It was I was not prepared for this in any way, mm-hmm. shape, or form, and I'm guessing most people aren't. And so you're not only trying to care for this person that you love, you're also trying to figure out what the heck are you doing for yourself, mm-hmm. and how can the two mix. I mean, it's just a very totally confusing time.
Absolutely.
And you're not trained in any way. So you're looking for anything to give you the information to be able to help, not just yourself, but the person mm-hmm. that you're caring for.
Absolutely. I see some, you know, as we move into having more and more of our population aging and with chronic disease, I think mm-hmm. it's going to become more and more important. And so I think we need to start thinking creatively how this becomes an integral part of the whole package of managing chronic life-limiting.
Right.
And how can we take this, you know, in the virtual world? If you can't leave for caregiving, could you be part of an online meditation group or something?
This could be a whole specialty in and of itself, don't you think, Pam? I mean,
I'm excited. And I've been in this.
I think so.
I've been in this business since the late 70s, and I haven't been excited since. You know, for a long time about the possibilities
yeah.
here. So,
that is wonderful. We've got about
yeah.
3 minutes left to our show, 2 minutes actually. And I hope you'll, now that I have this national audience as my witness, I hope you'll come back.
I would love to be invited.
We've only started the conversation. And one thing I want, isn't it very important for us to be able to tell our story as part of healing? We kind of didn't get into that too much, but I think that's very important, isn't it? And I also wanted you to give your contact information so that people know where you are, because you help so many people, not only in Massachusetts, but elsewhere. And so could you give that information?
Absolutely.
And we will keep in touch. We're going to have you back, definitely.
I would love to come back and talk about telling our stories and really honoring the stories of health and wellness, but also illness. And so thank you. I would love people to visit my website, which is stressresources.com. And
mm-hmm.
I also am on Twitter, for those who are on Twitter. And that's Pam Ressler, just PamRessler. And they can also visit my company's Facebook page, where I post a lot of the information that we talked about today. And that would be facebook.com/stressresources. And a third place would be I do write a blog called, and they can get that just by Googling, but it is a Blogspot blog. So that's pamressler.blogspot.com.
All right. Well, that is wonderful. Thank you so much for your inspiring hour. We have a lot to think about. You've given me hope that I can meditate in the future. And we will keep in touch. And I've made a new friend, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you have too. Everyone, please listen. We'll have a blog tomorrow for you. And please do stay tuned. Go to DonnaGore.com. And stay tuned next week for another wonderful show with Shattered Lives. And thank you, Delilah. Thank you, Pam. Good evening.
Well, I hope everybody doesn't hang up and go away, because we have another full hour. So.
Yes, please do.
Yes,
please stay. Stay tuned.
There, hang into the. You know, just hang on. We. You know.
Hang on.
Maybe
Pam will listen too.
I will be.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. We've connected people, my goal in life. With that, I'm going to sign off right now. But so thank you very much, Delilah. Thank you, Pam, and we'll be in touch, okay?
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, ladies.
All right. Good evening. Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of the extraordinary and wonderful ImaginePublicity.com. Please do check it out, everyone. It's a wonderful website. So, good evening, Delilah. How are you?
I'm good, Donna. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine here. It's awfully chilly here, but I'm wonderful just the same. And I'm very, very happy because we have a very special guest this evening that we had to put on hold for a little while, but as they say, good things come to those who wait, right? That's for sure. And it's kind of a change of pace show because we're not featuring anything about crime. However, if people don't heed the advice of Dr. Delilah Corey, they could indeed have shattered lives, couldn't they, Delilah? Because Dr. Corey has many specialties. Let me just give a thumbnail sketch of her bio, and then we'll bring her in very shortly. And as you know her personally as I do, I'm sure that you could shed light on some things. Dr. Delilah Corey is the founder of AwareMed Institute and the director of Wellness U program at a spot in North Myrtle Beach Plantation. Her specialties and accumulated experience are in emergency medicine, pediatrics. She's certified in anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. She has a master's degree in public health. And currently she runs her institute from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And I've had the distinct pleasure of meeting her personally and also receiving some treatment. And I have to say that it has truly changed my life. And we have a two-pronged approach here this evening. We are Dr. Corey kind of has a double life, but in a positive sense, okay? During the week, she does all about health and wellness, mind, body, and spirit. But on the weekends, she is also a traditional doctor, and her one love in the traditional sense is emergency medicine. And I think there are a lot of people out there that might be interested in what is it like to work in the ER these days in 2013 with the demands that are placed and people not having the money for health care and just the chaotic nature of what happened. So we're going to talk about the ER first, and then we're going to go into her other specialty. So Dr. Corey, as we like to call her, Dr. Dolly, thank you so much for being on Shattered Lives. It's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Donna. It's wonderful and a pleasure to be with you on your show, and I appreciate everything you're doing for all your listeners. I am sure you're bringing in a lot of great information to every single one of them, and that empowers everybody that listens to you, and I am very grateful to be a partner with you and with Delilah with Imagine Publicity. So I'm very grateful to be on your show today, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, believe me, it's a pleasure, and this show and working with you and Delilah is a labor of love. So with that said, why don't we talk a bit about, you know, how you actually you didn't come into the health and wellness or naturopathic realm right away. You were trained traditionally, and you were in the emergency room realm first. Isn't that right?
Well, Donna, I am going to just give you a little briefing and very quick about who I am and where I'm coming from and where I'm headed and where I am today. And I think that would help you understand why I do what I do. Well, I was born in Egypt, and when I was 17, my very dear father passed away from pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was a turning point in my entire life. And from then on, I knew I am not going to be an engineer anymore, because my dream was to become an engineer exactly like my father was. However, that was the turning point to say, I have to find a cure for cancer. Back then, I thought it's so easy to find a cure for cancer, so my endeavor was to learn medicine. So I became a medical doctor. I trained in Egypt, and then I had to come back to the U.S. and had to repeat all my training because I felt if I would come here, I'd be able to participate in big research and find a cure for cancer. And I trained in pediatrics here, and then I trained in pediatric hematology and oncology, which really is the science of blood and cancer in children. And I worked with the CDC in some research on genetic transformation that occur just before or after cancer. And I ended up doing emergency medicine, and I never understood why did I go from dreaming to become an engineer, to become a doctor, to become a pediatric oncologist, and then become an ER. And I kept asking God, why is that? And I did not know that this whole path was preparing me for the journey and my mission that is today. So I'm grateful that I had to go through an entire experience that helped me to decide that traditional medicine is not the prescription for health and wellness.
Now, did you discover that ER was part of, ER was one of your rotations that you had to do, is that correct?
Well, I had to become an ER doctor back in 1990, and that was, the first part of that was necessity. I had to really supplement my income so I can support my family, and eventually I had to succumb totally to emergency medicine because I went to a dentist who served my lingual nerve, which is messed up my tongue, and I could not communicate with parents enough to be an educator. Being a doctor, you really have to be an educator, especially if you're a pediatrician. So I went into into emergency medicine back in 1990, and I boarded in emergency medicine. And I am still practicing emergency medicine. So I practice emergency medicine since 1990 until today.
That's quite a long time, and it's a very high stress level in there. Although I would imagine it's a little bit different if you're in a smaller town versus a big city. Can you talk a little bit about your present-day experiences in the ER and what happens, and maybe compare a little bit about what it was like in 1990 versus now?
Oh, my goodness. Donna, it's
so different.
It's an evolution that is really beyond imagination. Back then, the human touch was happening between a doctor and a patient and a nurse. Most of the time, nobody else dictated the course of the therapy or treatment of patients. But now it's all not only computerized, but you as a patient become one more number and one more computer. So we design now protocols. As soon as somebody comes in with chest pain, there is a protocol that is followed. You know, they have an algorithm. So it's like a cookbook. So everybody is treated exactly the same way. There's a certain battery of testing, certain battery of protocol that is followed. And the doctor has a minute per patient because in a very busy ER, we could see up to 3 to 4 patients an hour with high acuity. So imagine a person with high acuity, how much more do you need with a patient like this? So
did you say 1 minute per patient?
By the time, you see the patient, the nurse has a history.
Uh-huh.
You go in and say, hi, how are you doing? You put you have the history already pre-taken by a nurse. You just quickly review that history. It's all in the computer. So it takes more time to complete the chart than to spend with the patient. So you go in, you order, like you have a chest pain. Well, I do understand. Now, it's cardiac. So I have to do a battery of testing to confirm it's not heart disease or heart disease. If it's heart disease, we call the cardiologist or is it the patient, and you submit to either a heart attack situation or it's a rule out, which is ruling out. So there is protocols, rule out, go get admitted for 23 hours observation, then they get an echo the next. In my sleep, I can do it. And that's not medicine. That is not medicine.
And there's no privacy really per se where you can have a interactive conversation with them or privacy. Like you say, it's just kind of boom, 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 and you're done. Is that right? On to the next one.
I mean, you have to see the volume. And now with Obamacare, as you mentioned earlier, we are going to be seeing a larger volume. You're going to only have one doctor. The majority of now ER is also there's extenders, there's nurse practitioners, they're not trained as an ER physician, but they're now taking a major role to make decisions. We don't follow what they do anymore. We just go sign some of their orders. So it's really kind of a very fast paced lifestyle. So you can't change people's life in 5 minutes. You can't talk about what their eating habits are. You can't get to know what happened to their family. What really precipitated the heart attack? Was it an emotional stress? Was it a family? Was it a bitterness? You don't really have time to hold their hands. You just have to address, put another Band-Aid very quickly or triage them to the next level. You know, I triage them to either be discharged or admitted to its specialty. If it's a surgical case, it goes to surgery. If it's a gunshot wound, it goes to a certain situation. So we have algorithms. So everything is following one similar cookbook algorithm. That's really what medicine and the eat is.
Right.
But we see a lot of lonely people with chronic pain syndromes, people who just have continuous GI issues and they come over and over and over and over for the very same problem, whether it's hypertension, whether it's heart attack. I mean, people are having, so if it's the same problem over and over and you have them on tons of drugs, it means you're not helping them or they wouldn't be back.
Right, you're treating a symptom versus the actual cause, isn't that right?
Yes. The functional medicine model that I propose is to really address things at the root cause. Once you address them at the root cause, you really take care of them for good. And that's really my objective. And even beyond that, I become proactive by using preventive techniques. You know, most of the heart attacks are preventable. Most of the seizures are preventable. Most of asthma attacks are preventable. Most of heart attacks are preventable. Everything. So my dream is to create an awareness and allow my patients and allow the public to become proactive. If they can become the CEO of their own health and they can now decipher between the good, the bad, and the ugly, at least they know what we're talking about. So,
Can you do that in that environment? Are you saying you want to formulate your dream in your other environment and that you can't really change something in the ER environment, so you do what you can in that situation? Is that what you're telling us?
It's very hard in an ER setting to really help people change their life. You can begin maybe planting a seed in an ER like saying, hey, you're diabetic. Have you ever thought about this kind of food? Have you ever thought about the stress? Have you ever thought about your cortisol level? Have you ever thought about the effect of stress on you. So perhaps that's just the beginning.
You plan to see that.
Create an awareness, yes.
And are you able to give them written information going out the door, or is there some kind of follow-up that you can do that isn't interpersonal, so at least if they want to follow up, they can?
There, it's a little bit more open than it used to be, but it's still not traditional enough, and some ERs would reprimand a physician who would really try to use non-traditional teaching. Like if you have a diabetic and you tell them, hey, listen, you need to take probiotics. You need to make sure your magnesium level is up. Some of the nurses may come to you and say, I'm sorry, we cannot give these instructions to the patient. So you may verbally say them, hoping that these patients may retain some of them.
Okay.
But it's not traditional. It's not really what I can say. I can't tell a patient, hey, listen, your blood pressure can be really controlled better if you do controlled breathing probe exercises, or if you take a higher magnesium level, or if you eat more stuff that have L-arginine. It's not really, it's frowned upon. I still do it because I can't have it.
In good conscience, yeah, how can you, knowing you, you know, excuse me, a bit on the personal level and having to deal with this dichotomy of you know what's right and you know what you want to tell them, but yet you're kind of hamstrung with the protocols and whatnot, it's got to be very frustrating. It's got to be very, very frustrating. Can you tell us what is the most frequent type of, are there a certain percentage where you're getting, you know, like gunshot wounds and injuries from violence, or you're getting a majority of diabetics and heart attacks in the door, and you're getting people with just very minor problems? I mean, what is the typical flow these days about who comes in the door?
Well, it really is kind of very strange. It depends on the geographic location. So in some, I do ER all over the country, actually. But so in some areas, you'll see more violence or crime-related illnesses. Some of them would be MVCs, which is motor vehicle crashes from alcohol, drugs, and stuff like that. So you can see some, you know, stab wounds. You know, I've seen almost everything. Maybe 40% of what we see is repeat visitors, people who come for the same thing over and over and over and over again. It all depends, really. I was in places where you had, I was the only MD and one RN, and we would have, a person with a premature labor, a guy with what we call a massive acute MI, was a heart attack. We had to, what we call, give thrombolytics to, which means give a blood thinner in a specific way, clot busters. And we had a person who had a stroke at the same time, and it was just, these things do happen. But we still see 40% of the cases that are non-acute cases who could have been treated at home, or if it was when my grandmother was alive, those things would have been traditional. A child with a low-grade fever, you know, that could be taken care of at the moment until you see a PCP, or a person with abdominal pains that's been going on for the last 10 years on and off. So you can see those too, but I feel that I sympathize with every single patient, anybody who comes to the ER. I do want to help, but I feel like it's not the effective and efficient way to get health care. So it's a very inefficient and a very expensive way to receive proper health care. I think the true health care has to come from understanding the reason for disease and understand what causes the disease, become more involved and in tune with your body, understand that food is medicine, understand that laughter is medicine, understand that every choice you make creates an environment in your body that either a hostile environment in your body, which it's a pro-cancer environment, any bad environment is a pro-cancerous environment, which is any chaotic environment, internal environment, because the internal environment really makes the milieu or the media for certain illnesses to grow. So if you have the right environment, you'll have arthritis, or you'll start having diabetes, or so you are creating your own internal milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what most people don't realize, the power they have. Am I too fast?
No, you're doing fine. I'm following you. I just wondered also, are there different models like in other countries in terms of how they deal with emergency medicine? I mean, is this unique unto how we do things? Or is it done differently elsewhere?
Well, things have evolved in this country because of the change in healthcare, and because everything is becoming electronic. Dealing with electronics, everything is electronic now. So the human touch, the healing hand that was supposed to be delivered and a coaching hand does not exist anymore. And now it's a pharmaceutical soup that is offered. So it depends on the soup for the chewer or the soup.
That's interesting the way you say that. Pharmaceutical soup, I like that. Wow.
And one drug can counteract the effect of the other, and there's something called polypharmacia, which means people are on too many drugs, and these drugs have not been ever studied together in one setting. So you'd have 3 high blood pressure medication on board, 2 cholesterol medication on board, with 1 medication for prostate issue, plus 1 medication for seizures, plus you're smoking, plus you're drinking, plus you're taking calories, and then you expect that body to work very efficiently. It's almost like you're pouring everything in one same bucket and expect anything good to come out.
Right, you stir it up, and it's supposed to be magic. And you know, it's not the number of pills you give. You know, and I don't know. I guess people just don't understand that. We're going to spend another few minutes on this topic, but Delilah, I wanted to bring you in here just to see if you had some questions regarding this issue per se.
Well, I think one question that I have just in watching Grey's Anatomy and shows like that where you see medicine practiced on television. But one of the topics that came up in the recent show, and I just wanted to know if Dr. Corey knew if this was something that is ongoing in a lot of hospitals. They actually did away with the ER and trauma care. So basically, whatever, you know, this fictional hospital on television is doing now is just treating, you know, elective things. They're very focused on specifics rather than being a hospital for all people. Have you seen this happening?
In an ER setting? No. ERs are open. And as I said to you before we leave, Delilah, that for me, if I wasn't doing ER, I could not do any other part of medicine along with regenerative or anti-aging medicine. ER is acute intervention, and that's the only reason I'm still doing any traditional medicine, is because this is just a quick stabilization of a situation that needs to be addressed. If somebody's bleeding to death, I stop the bleeding. I know how to do that. Somebody's having a massive heart attack, I can reverse this very quickly. somebody who has a stabbing one, I can address this in a very quick manner. Somebody with severe respiratory distress. So it's like a very quick fix. And that's the only time there's a quick fix. It's just an emergency. It's like what it means, emergency.
Right.
You stop the leak until you get somebody to fix the leak. You just come and turn off the leaking valve and then and put it into a stable state until that's addressed later. Now,
right.
It never is addressed anymore.
You so, just have to think quick on your feet perpetually from one thing to the next. Can you tell me how many, do you see a good percentage of people who come in who are homeless as well as children? They may not have, you know, a family doctor. They don't qualify for insurance. What percentage do you see of those two populations?
Well, I consider almost homeless who means they're literally homeless, don't have homes, maybe 1%, or maybe half a percent. But these homeless people who come actually come to the ER only in the winter time because it's cold. So they'll come either intoxicated, or they're found kind of passed out on the street, or they had a seizure passing out. So they'll come. Most of the time, they tune them up. They give them all the fluids that they need because they're dehydrated. They warm them up. And back they go. You offer them shelters. They won't go back to shelters. But they use the hospital as a temporary solution to a chronic problem.
Do you have some water there?
I think as we've seen, the medical, mainstream medical, traditional medical system as a whole has changed drastically, and it's not been all for the better. And I think we're seeing that people cannot afford health care. It's kind of a choice between food or health care. What are you going to do? And
hard choices.
Right, and it's not necessarily just the poor population of the country. It's the middle class. It's people who are hanging on to their cars and their homes by a thread and having to make those hard choices as to where the best place to get medical care is. And most, I would venture to say, don't look to the prevention side of it. So they're not seeing a doctor until it actually is an emergency situation.
An acute situation, right. Yes.
If we are living in that situation, if this is what health care is, this is really, it's called sickness care. So you've got to be very sick before you seek any, it's very expensive, it's very draining, and it's very hopeless. Because if you come to me, or I go to someone at the very last thread there is left, there's very little they can do for you. You really want to become more proactive. Listen, we are in a free society still. It's a demand. If there's no demand, you know, it's a supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't go to the ERs, if we use the ER separate in a different way, we create the demand. We people have more power than we think. If we're not happy with this kind of health care, we can be pro other health care, which is really a more inclusive, a total inclusive protocol that includes the spirit, the mind, and the body.
Right.
People
and
really
I think that you've said it all there. That would be probably a good segue to say the other side of the coin, because we're pretty much at the halfway point of our show right now, and I do want to discuss many things that you do outside of the ER. It's just that I think it's really hard for people to make the transition, Dr. Corey. I mean, I was very impressed with what I saw when I first saw you, but it's not like in that movie you had me from hello. I had to think about it somewhat and process the things that you were saying, and I had to agree to make changes even though maybe they weren't the most convenient. But in other words, over a period of time, you learn that this is the better way and this is the better path. And so with that, I'd like to tell people what you have written on your website with regard to your mission. And then I want to make an announcement about a really exciting retreat, and I'd love to have you spend the rest of the time, if you were talking about wellness and your other love in non-traditional medicine, if that's okay. Okay.
Well, I'm honestly honored to answer any of your questions, whether it has to do with emergency medicine. My pleasure. Emergency medicine or my evolution into that
new evolution, right? And what you had said in terms of describing your mission was, quote, to ignite the spark of health deep within everyone and to allow the sparkle of wellness to shine through everyone's eyes, becoming one with the universe and aligning body, mind, and spirit. So that, I don't know, I think that it sounds like poetry to me. It's beautiful, but yet there's a lot of truth in it. And I see that, you know, you do treat the entire person. And there is a lot of hands-on. And, you know, people don't get that in an emergency room, as you have said. And so with that, I want to just introduce the fact that you are having an event coming up that you're planning very hard for, and you can go into it in a little more detail, and then we can discuss it. You are doing what you call a Wellness U retreat, and I believe it's at your institute, right, on Friday, April 5th, or Saturday, April 6th, coming up, and it is a full day of mind, body, and spirit treatment in terms of wellness and education and discussion and ongoing participatory activities and that type of thing, isn't it right?
Exactly. You described it beautifully. But let me tell you, why did I come up with the word wellness you?
Okay.
And it's a wellness you, like the letter U, which means universe, wellness universe. And the wellness, it's wellness you, it's a wellness university. And wellness you is a wellness you turn back to a healthier you. You turn back to you turn your cardiac disease back. You turn your cancer back. So you make a U-turn. That's why the wellness you is, and the wellness you is mean you are the wellness. So that's why I came up with the word wellness, and the you is all that is the universe, is a university, is an education. So it summarizes everything I want to say. So the patient. The patient or the client or the participants become the center of this.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of us who are going to be in helping them, we created this, in order for us to facilitate and coach them to find themselves and to rediscover the sparkle that I was talking about, because they have this deep within. They just did not know that they have access to it and they're in control of it. So we're going to be teaching them how to find it and how to really align their body, mind, and spirit with the universe and become one with it in order for them to beat every illness or dis-ease that ever happens. And for me, I have been really meditating, and I've been pondering and been thinking about who we are and what we are. And food is really the planet God, if I may say, has created everything in that universe to heal itself. So in the universe, everything exists. So food is your medicine, and I'm going to give people understanding of all these diets that people are, you know, what diet to choose. I mean, why do you think this one is better than that one? Why do you do this? I mean, there's so many biases. Mm-hmm. There's so many choices, and everyone is backing itself with a lot of research and this and that. So why? It's what in fashion is to this week, what diet is of. Mm-hmm. So really, people need to understand why is that diet work and what diet works for what condition.
Right. Now, is it going to be set up so that you have different modules that they choose from, or does everybody go through the same, all of the different offerings that you have within the full day, or you cherry pick and choose certain things, or how does it go?
Well, thank you for asking. No, this is the introduction to it, so we can get people become aware of the forum that we're going to enter.
Okay.
And then the forum is going to evolve into different module, and we're going to develop a module for weight. I don't like to call it weight loss or weight gain or whatever it is. I like to call it optimization of weight for you. So a weight, one in diabetes and weight together. Another module is going to be on cardiovascular health, which is strokes prevention and heart attack prevention and high blood pressure prevention and cholesterol issues. We're going to have another module about cancer and how to protect your body from cancer and how to not attract cancer, because to me, cancer is an invited guest that is not welcome. So we invite cancer. We're that powerful. Cancer comes.
Well, I would say uninvited guest, right? It's uninvited.
It's an invited, because you make choices to let him come. He's invited because of choices you've made, but he's not welcome.
You
when
have to uninvite. Yes.
It's an invited. You invite him because you're making choices. You're eating food that invites cancer, but you don't think you're inviting cancer, but you are. And then when it comes in, you say, "Oh, you're not welcome. I didn't invite you, but you did." In subtle ways, you did. By eating sugars, you did. By eating acidic food, you did. By making your body acidic, you did. So you have, unfortunately, subconsciously invited that, like any other disease we have, except for a few that are genetics or happen. So most of them are invited. We invite these diseases. We've opened the door for them. They come in and then say, "Hey, why did you come in?" Well, the door is open. So we need to know how to control the door. Allow diseases in or not. Yes.
And people can no longer use the excuse of "I didn't know," right? Because there's such a plethora of information out there regarding these issues. I mean, maybe not all of it is accurate. You have to really be very careful about what you read online. But they can't come in from a point of ignorance and say, "Nobody ever told me," because the information is out there. Isn't that true?
Yes, there is a plethora of information, but you have to learn how to dig in the right information, because you do not want to pick up the wrong information. There
well,
is
how
too
do you
many
be a good consumer then?
That's where you need people like, and I hate to say just like me, but people who have invested their time and money and effort to learn, to understand with science, why is that for what? Like, for example, what is ketogenic diet? You know, you have to decipher the literature. Some people embark on stuff because there is a financial reward on this, you know? And now... And the raspberry ketones are everywhere. Everybody is buying raspberry ketones. Well, that's just the miracle that's going to really make you all lose weight. You know, there is some truth to that, but it's not, you know, it is a hype. You know, some people just take it and fly with it, and it's about the financial reward. It's not, there's no quick fixes. There is a quick temporization of things. Like ER is a quick stabilization for a very short time. You need to address the issue. So people have to stop thinking that there's a quick fix. It doesn't work. It does not work. The whole
right.
universe heals together. When you align your body, you know, plants are healing.
Right. And there's
plants.
No, can you explain to us about the fact that you can kind of make the treatment plan or the game plan and you can lead the person down the path, but the commitment has to come from you and, you know, the everyday perseverance and the time commitment and doing all those other things. That's not the physician's responsibility. That's your responsibility, and that you have to intrinsically know that that's what you need to do, just not just because the doctor said you should, right?
Well, you know, like I said, you invest in that process. This is you. So you can use the doctor as a coach or as a tool. But
mm-hmm.
ultimately, this is your decision. But you have to understand, change is not easy. We
right.
all go through all the stages of changes. And sometimes we are in the contemplation phase, and sometimes we're in different phases. So we have to be aware that you have to understand where you're at in that cycle, and you have to understand that you need support. We're all here to help each other, and you're going to be bouncing back and forth between wanting to or not wanting to. So the truth of the matter is, yes, you're investing in this. It's a process. It's a transformation. It's a beautiful transformation, but it takes time to build a beautiful home. You
mm-hmm.
have, first of all, we lay out the foundation. So when you come and see me for the first time, we lay out the foundation. Then put the next level, and then the next level, and the next level. So that's really what we do is, number one, understand what the problem is, foundation. Once you lay out the foundation, you start manipulating, changing, looking at, and then every time you succeed, even every small success, pushes you to the next level. If you would do something and you see no response to it and no results, you would not do it. You'll be discouraged. Like, for example, had I treated someone with acne and they don't see any improvement from all the hard work, why would they continue to do it? They were not. So every success is a step to the next step, to the
mm-hmm.
next level. So I believe that we have to learn to embrace every success. We have to encourage ourselves. We have to become part of a support group. That's why I'm creating all these retreats, so people can create their own support group. I want to have a blog part of the retreat where people can blog, teach each other, help each other. I want to moderate this and help them to understand that they are supported not only by their peers, but also by me and by a lot of people who are very well trained, whether in energy medicine or regenerative medicine or functional medicine. So people who have extreme experience in exercise medicine, botanical, herbology. I mean, everything. I'm going to try to arm this retreat program or retreat school with every person with all the experience they can have to offer all the participants the,
mm-hmm.
the support they need for to embark on a beautiful transformation.
Right.
So that we
don't forget that, can you give us some information with regard to how they might register, and is there a range of fees involved, and where they might contact you if they're interested in going to either the Friday or the Saturday retreat?
Yes. We're going to have a form on the website, and they can pay through PayPal, but they also can call the office at 843-213-1480. Delilah is going to be also involved with the process. We're going to have, Delilah, correct me if I'm wrong, we're going to have all the forms on every forum possible. It's going to be on Facebook. Facebook,
yeah.
It's going to be on LinkedIn, it's going to be on my website, it's going to be in our newsletter.
Yeah.
We encourage everyone to sign up for our newsletter. We'll be more than happy to send them updates. They can also get webinars. Everything, they can be part of this whole thing. This is an introductory one. It's going to be at a very mild cost. It's going to be the lowest in the country, but we're willing to do this so that we can help people. So it's going to be about 150. Is that correct, Donna? Peggy?
It's $199, but we're offering an early bird special for $150 if they sign up early. So.
And what's the deadline, Delilah?
March 15th. Yeah, March 15th is the deadline to sign up for the early bird special. We may do some others before that, but to get it at $150, it would be March 15th is the deadline. But it
do you feed people on that day?
Pardon me?
Do you feed people on that day too?
It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to offer, you know, obviously we're going to do some educational things. Dr. Corey will be just giving kind of briefly touching on all of the different things that she does through, you know, through AwareMed and how she treats different conditions. But we're not focusing on any particular condition at this one. We will in the future. So there will be retreats for learning about cancer, about weight loss or weight gain or whatever
addiction
she called it earlier. Addictions, yes. So we'll touch on that at this retreat, but it's going to be, you know, educational. It's going to be fun. We're going to do yoga. We're going to do meditation. So we'll have, you know, grounding type exercises. We'll have some other things. We'll have a juicing demonstration. We'll talk about juicing and the benefits to everyone. And I think the biggest point that I want to make is that this is open for everyone. It's not just people who are already fit and healthy and want to learn how to stay that way. It's not just for sick people. It's for everybody. Where you are in your state of health, you start where you are. So this is kind of where you are. Come on, greet and meet everybody else who are where they are, and let's get moving forward.
Oh, it sounds like fun. I want to come.
It's really going to be a lot of fun. And also, we're going to be creating ones for health practitioners, whether they're nurse practitioners, nurses, RNs, LPNs, physician assistant, medical doctors, so that we can really start creating the concept of wellness instead of illness. Mm-hmm. So we want instead of hospitals, have hospitalities, you know. We want to really create a forum of a membership of well people, wellness concept.
Mm-hmm.
We're all buying into wellness and health, not into sickness and disease, you know.
Right.
Sick care is very expensive. Well care is very inexpensive, and it is fun.
Is this introductory retreat open to the general public and also the medical community, if you can get them interested?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Absolutely. We're going to, the first one is going to be for everyone, and then the next ones are going to be, they're going to have programs for the public and programs for the healthcare industry at the same time. So they'll have a different forum, but they're also going to mingle so that people can meet and greet with the doctors and the healthcare providers. And it's going to be a hybrid between the wellness the wellness community that will involve the providers and the participants. So it's going to be really, we have a dream to create the best forum on not only the international forum that we're trying to create together.
Well, it sounds very innovative. And now correct me, you're having this off-site. It's not at AwareMed, correct?
Well, this one is going to be at AwareMed, but after that it's going to be off-site, depending on the volume. For here, we can seat up to 40 people per session. And here, we divide them into two groups here.
Okay.
And 40 for Saturday and 40 for Sunday. But if we have larger groups, we're going to have the right forum, and we're going to have some long retreats, like a long weekend retreat. These are the next ones. We're going to announce those. We're going to have them almost ready to be announced on the day of the retreat. So if people want to sign up, they're going to get a discount. But my dream is to really see the community of wellness enlarge and the community of sickness become smaller. Then healthcare costs is going to have to go down. That's the only way that healthcare costs will go down. That's the only way sick people are not going to be sick anymore. We're not going to talk about sickness. You have a friend, and her name is Susan Murphy Milano,
and she's our
friend, and her dream was very similar to mine, is help people to recognize that they have choices and that we can create forums to help them. And all of us are partners in the same on the same path to really help people recognize that they have choices. So that's what this is all about. You choose wellness instead of illness.
Well, I think it's more than a dream. I think it can be a reality, but as they say, sort of the elephant in the room that doesn't get talked about a lot is the fact that the traditional medical community does not recognize a lot of these methods, and thereby those of us that go for treatment, we don't take insurance, or, you know, maybe they can't afford this procedure. What are you doing to address those questions right now, and what do you foresee in the future? Is it going to be better if we can convince more people in the medical community? And, you know, because people don't know coming. They're used to going in there, filling out a few forms and say, here, submit this to my insurance company. It doesn't actually work like that all the time.
Well, I'm going to tell you my personal feeling about this. There is a time where you're ready. And I believe that the same way that most participants are ready, a lot of medical doctors are ready. They're all frustrated with the system. They all went into medical school with one dream, is to contribute to the healing. So most of them, whether they want to admit or not, they are healers in heart. They wanted to be healers. They're faced with a system that is not the system that they anticipated. They thought they are medical healers. They thought their contributions is going to be amazing. And when they come to reality, they have to realize that we are under the influence of Big Pharma. We're under the influence of politics. We are really prescribers. What we do is our signature for all these drugs is worth a lot more than anybody thinks. Every time we sign for a prescription, whether we are gaining out of it or not, we're making somebody very, very wealthy. But at the same time, we're making some of our patients sick. Most of these drugs are very dangerous. You have to be very conscious that, you know, medicine of tomorrow is not going to need a lot of drugs. Food is medicine, you know. So there is a lot of botanical that are medical stuff. But also they could be dangerous if they're used the wrong way. So people need to become in-tuned. And a lot of professionals and medical professionals are almost ready. They just want us to give hands to them and invite them in. They're ready. they are almost ready. It just, they also cannot deny success. Every one of them wants to see successful stories. Now, mm-hmm. if you're my patient, for example, and if you're feeling better, you'll share with the world about it. So then you help others and others and others. But if you come to me and you're getting worse instead of better, why would you even take that path? So if we are going to create success by really creating a true wellness, if we have a true treasure, it's going to be discovered, I promise. If we mm-hmm. offer a joke, if what we offer is a fad, it's not going to take off, I promise. Mm-hmm. So if our commitment is because we have the true treasure, the true diamond, the truth, mm-hmm. you are going to have many, many followers. If what we bring to the table is just a piece of junk, it's not going to take off.
That's true. And
so
yeah.
If we're offering the right thing, the right energy will put it together, mm-hmm. and the right chemistry of people are going to coalesce.
That's cool. Well, we have about 3 minutes or so left. I have one or two other questions. Is it harder, in your opinion, Dr. Corey, to convince the medical community or the general public as to the benefits of what you do and what you can do to change your life for the better? I know you have challenges in both areas, but is it harder with the medical community or the general public because of what they see on TV commercials, et cetera?
Well, I have to tell you, there are two different levels of awareness right now. The
uh-huh.
public is a little bit more aware than the medical community. We are under the influence of Big Pharma, but there is
uh-huh.
a huge awareness that is beginning in the medical community. I'm part of a big, larger medical community that has embraced wellness,
mm-hmm.
and they have stayed away from the other traditional medicine. So I'm grateful to be part of this, but I wish I was the pioneer in it. There's many, many people before me and after me who sacrificed their entire life to see this come to fruition. Now,
mm-hmm.
I was going to this direction regardless, I think, but I'm very grateful to all the people who are forefathers of this movement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the medical community is lagging, but it's taking on. Yes, the public is already, has embarked already on the movement. Unfortunately, the medical community is slower to take on.
They're
dragging
behind, huh? Well, I think there's always hope. Right, there is always hope. And I think that, like what you said, it only takes one person to pass things along. It's like that old telephone game, and you just keep passing the message on and on. And hopefully it will get to the right people. This retreat sounds wonderful. I know it's going to be a huge success. Please do give your contact information again for people, and then we will be putting the show on air, and I will be writing a blog so we can pass this along as well. So can you just give that information, Dr. Corey, before we sign off?
Yes. The retreat is going to be on April the 5th and 6th. It's
yeah.
a one-day retreat, and we're going to have the registration form ready to go within a day or two. It's
yep.
going to be published on our website, awaremed.com. It's going to
okay.
be published on imaginepublicity.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to also be on my LinkedIn account. It's going to be
Very
on
good.
Our Twitter. It's going to be on all the Facebooks we have. It's
yep.
going to be also we're going to have press releases. And we're going to have newsletter. Anybody
good.
Who wants to subscribe to our newsletter, I would be very much encouraged to do so. They're going to be receiving
yeah.
weekly
good.
Updates.
And you're on Facebook yeah. and Twitter and all of that, right?
Yes, Facebook,
yeah.
Twitter, LinkedIn.
Very good. Well, we're going to have to sign off at this moment, but I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Corey. It's been a very big learning experience. I hope people will appreciate this. We're going to promote this. And, Delilah, thank you so much for your work here and your work with Dr. Corey. We appreciate it. And, everyone, please do stay tuned to the next episode next Saturday evening to Shattered Lives. Good night. Thank you.